Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to a beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Spring Developer Advocate Josh Long, and this show is all about the real heroes behind Spring and its ecosystem.
Hi, Spring fans. Welcome to another installment of the beautiful podcast. How are you? It's the 7th of March, 2024. I cannot believe it. You know, just a week ago, it was pouring cats and dogs here in San Francisco, and now I'm looking out my window. It's been a long day, and it's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon for me here in California. But I've been on calls, I've been on meetings since, well, 7, basically, which means I was up 6 in the morning, which if you don't know me that well after these many years, then maybe now is the right time to tell you, I'm not a morning person, people. I am have calls with folks all around the world, late into the night person, but not a morning person. Morning people, I'm sure, are doing it right, okay? I'm not saying I know something they don't, quite the contrary. It's just that I'm not one of them. And so I've been awake for a long time now, 6 hours. And just really excited though. That said, because I'm looking out the window, it's sunshine. The days are getting longer. Have you noticed that? It's springtime almost. In a few short weeks, it'll be springtime, my absolute all-time Double Dutch favorite season of the year. And my all-time favorite framework of the millennia, of course. And it's just been a very busy week. I cannot believe it's Thursday. You know, I'm glad I do these podcasts every Thursday because by the time these episodes go out, I am winding down for the week. I have meetings today and tomorrow, of course, and I've got my usual work to do, but I am already thinking about what kind of time I'm going to spend in the park this weekend. Just touching grass, you know, just like find your center. You got to like get out there and just relax a little bit to appreciate just how good things are. And I spent some time this morning, you know, and and really, things are just, I mean, and I don't know how to put it. Have you ever played like a video game where you got like really good and then at the end of the game, things become too easy, right? Because your character is like all maxed out, you know, leveled up and everything. And sometimes I feel like that with Spring. Like I feel like, but it's not me, obviously. It's certainly not me. What I mean is it's getting too easy sometimes, you know, it almost feels like it would be nice to have a little bit of a challenge every now and then. So this morning I was talking to a group about Spring Batch, which I love. I don't know if you know anything about Spring Batch, but basically the core conceit of Spring Batch is that there are some things that are just too big to handle in one fell swoop, you know, large sequential data access, you know, too much data. And, the canonical example is batch processing, you know, from a mainframe or something like that, right? Like I've got a CSV file and I want to read through all 500,000 rows and write them ETL, you know, read data, write it, process it, and then write it out to something else. But there's all sorts of things that fit in the sort of batch nomenclature, right? And I was talking to this group and they're using Spring Batch, and Spring Batch is the core paradigm is very simple, right? It's a job. Jobs have steps. Steps can optionally have either a combination of some permutation of a item reader, processor, or item writer, or, you know, to the exclusion of the reader, processor, and writer, you can have a task split. So steps can have one of the first three or the task split, but not both. And you can have more than one step, right? You can have N steps, and these things can, they work in chunks. So if you're using the steps to do reading and writing and processing, it'll read, let's say, 1,000 records at a time or whatever configured size you specify. And then it'll read one at a time, but it'll write 1,000 records at a time, right? That's called chunk-oriented processing. And this gives you the chance to be scalable, to be more efficient at runtime. Because of course, it's a lot more efficient to open up a network socket and write to your SQL database once every 10,000 records, as opposed to once every record, right? Batch things up in memory. 10,000, or maybe I'm just using 10,000 as a round number. If you've got like 1 million records, don't try and write a 1 million record transaction to the database. Do small, more manageable bite-sized chunks. And if one of them fails, then you can just mark that batch, that chunk for, you know, administration for somebody to come and look at it. But then the rest can be considered successful. So in that example, you'd have 990,000 written to the database correctly, but you'd still be missing 10,000, okay? Okay, so I love Spring Batch. But remember, it's Spring. And one of the nice things about Spring is it's a framework. It's open for extension, but closed for modification. And the way we do this, of course, is through dependency injection. That is to say, you plug in a peg in the machine, a cog in the machine that is of the right size and shape, and it'll just work. It doesn't matter whose implementation you're using, right? We do this through indirection and through interfaces, right? Well-known abstractions. And so Spring Batch is no different. The machinery for steps and all that is just pluggable. So you can use our default one and all that, but also you can plug in different ones. So we have this really interesting, you know, scalability story. You can actually process those steps, which are normally sequential. You can have, for example, in that file IO example that I just mentioned earlier, if you had a million records, you could read 200,000 records at a time in a thread. So you could have like four or five threads, and then you can do five threads, and that way you could read all the data and then process it, all of it basically at the same time, and effectively, you know, divide the amount of time it takes to do the processing by the number of threads that you've created. So that's really nice. If the work is too much to be done with a single node, you can farm the work out via some sort of messaging substrate. And of course, here we use Spring Integration. So we don't care what messaging substrate you use. You could use Kafka, you could use RabbitMQ, you could use a SQL database, you could use a distributed cache like Redis. It doesn't matter, right? You can, as long as there's a Spring Integration adapter, you're good to go, right? And then what you're doing there is you get to a virtual step, which then sends the offsets of the data to be read to these, you know, worker nodes, which are also themselves Spring Batch and Spring Innovation applications. They pull down the offsets and they read that sequence of data, and then they do the processing and they send the results back to the leader node, which is really cool when you think about it, right? Because now you can, and by the way, you can also really, you know, realistically, you could before that work is sent out across the messaging substrate, you could also use the Kubernetes Java API and have it spin up five different worker nodes, you know, with the container of your code, right? And now, as soon as you get to that step, you know, where you're going to actually do the work, there's five different workers eagerly waiting to process that data, right? They'll be listening. Then they'll get the data, they'll process it, and then you can shut all the worker nodes down, right? So it's just very dynamic and it's elastic, and you can do this all through the nice clean use of the remote partitioning mechanism in Spring Batch. So I set up a demo for a group this morning, like I said, and I just walked them through remote partitioning, and it works. It's really good, actually. Yeah. And that was just by the fact that the sample, I'm a little embarrassed to admit, is a little out of date, a little out of date. It's not actually using the latest and greatest Spring Batch. So I had to, you know, there's a few bumps in the road, but we got it working because, again, you know, it can't always be 100% easy. It's nice to have a little challenge every now and then. And then also, we made it work in GraalVM native images. That took, again, two classes, I think it was, where we needed to register a GraalVM hint. So it was like a total of five lines of code across two different code bases that were required to make this work. But it did work. And that was really cool. I mean, I just love this. Obviously, there's a lot of data, and the Spring Batch is a nice way to deal with that data. And then that pairs really nicely with something like Spring AI, which is, you know, how do I get that data into the Vector store in the first place? Use Spring Batch, you know. All right, my friend. Well, I'm just really excited about that Spring Batch stuff. And, you know, I'm really excited about Spring. And in general, I just feel like it's the easy button. And sometimes I just do amazing things. And I'm like, wow, I'm awesome. And then I realize, wait a minute, no. I wrote like 20 lines of code. Spring did the rest. And I'm going to take credit for it, though. And I really appreciate it. You know, I'm a big Spring fan. I was always a Spring fan long before I had the job of being its number one supporter. I was doing it for free, you know. And I'm just a big fan. So right now there's a survey out. I hope you are also a fan. If you are, we have the State of Spring survey. It's out. Okay. We want you to help us, right? I'm going to link to a blog here, tanzu.vmware.com/content/blog/contribute to the future of Spring with dashes in between the words. So contribute to the future of Spring. So go there and you can find the link to the State of Spring survey. It's live for a week until the 15th of March, basically. And we need your input. We want to know, what are we doing good? What are we doing bad? And, you know, maybe those two native hints should have been there. You know, I don't know. I'm hoping you get something out of it. And certainly to the extent that I've been a part of it, I hope you've enjoyed your journey with Spring thus far, and that you'll join us for and stay with us on the journey. I think it's just a really amazing ecosystem, and it's a really amazing time to be a Java Spring Boot developer. So please fill out the survey and spread the word. You know, I'm talking about software. I've been talking about how excited I am now today. You know, I'm just really excited about the state of the software ecosystem. But I think there's always this balance. There's this balancing act that we have to do in the software world, because it's mirrored by amazing leaps forward in hardware, right? Which is, you know, no doubt, right? I mean, look at the most amazing results that we see today. It's the marriage of amazing software and amazing infrastructure and amazing software and hardware, right? And so this is why I think companies like Apple are so phenomenal, because they do a pretty darn good job of all three of those things, right? All this stuff is really good. And the hardware itself is also a balancing act between hardware technicians and, physics. Like, the actual physics of the universe impact our ability to deliver better software. And if you don't believe that, then think again, right? There is just so much that had to go right for us to get the first working bit of RAM or CPU, any of this stuff working, right? And now we kind of take the stuff for granted, but every year, you know, the physicists are finding new ways to get more energy out of less and to make the chips that we are dealing with smaller and smaller, to the point where it's just uncanny, the incredible level of sophistication involved in all of this, right? And I think getting human beings to the moon was most amazing thing as human beings, and probably computers, right? Second most amazing. I cannot believe what we have managed to create, even in just the last 100 years, you know, the last 100 years of life. People are still alive when the first real computer started to go into use in businesses, you know, not widespread, certainly not at the beginning. But my point is, it's you probably have somebody in your life that was old enough to remember reading about this, or to have used some of these things. And I guess it's just really, it is because of this incredible synergy between the engineering disciplines and cultures and so on, that we get this amazing result. And a huge part of that is CERN, right? They talked to you about, I was just there last month in Geneva and in Ticino, Switzerland. And in Geneva, you know, it's not actually Geneva proper, it's just outside of it, but they have the CERN, you know, facility, or CERN, the site of CERN. CERN, of course, is CERN, capital letters. It's where they do all these crazy things that just blow the mind in physics. And obviously, that work in some part, in some ways, led to the creation of CERN, right? So it's just really interesting. CERN occupies such an important part in our world today. It is, I think, it's the only place of its kind like that, where so many countries from all around the planet converge in one place with one goal for so long a sustained period. It's like the Olympics for scientists, but instead of just being a couple of weeks once every 4 years, this goes on 24/7, every day, every year, right? Just an amazing place. And so I was very lucky to sit down with amazing engineers there, Christian Schutzer, who joined me for today's discussion. We talked about CERN itself. So consider this there's a lot of software, of course, but there's also a lot of just really cool stuff about CERN. So I really hope you get something out of today's episode, my friends. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, we did it. Hi, everybody. Let's see. Comments. Are we back? Did it disconnect or reconnect? I don't know. Are we still live? Yeah, it looks like we're still live. Hi, everybody. We're here. So, okay, we just had some Wi-Fi issues. Good morning. Hi, everyone. Yeah, there's people responding. We had some Wi-Fi issues, so beg your indulgence if this doesn't endure, but we're going to do our level-headed best. We are here in such a hallowed, wonderful place. I'm joined by Christian
Schuster,
okay? Yeah. And we are at
CERN.
The CERN. Like, what does CERN stand for? I mean, it's...
So CERN is actually a French acronym. It stands for Conseil Européen pour la Recherche Nucléaire, right? So I probably butchered that, but it basically means the European Organization for Nuclear Science.
Yeah. Wow. And then, and this is not a new place. This has been here since the 60s?
Yeah, since the 50s, actually. 50s. So CERN was founded in 1953, kind of as a result of post-war physics being moved over to the US and Europe being like, yeah, you know, we're falling a bit behind. So let's make a huge physics laboratory at Geneva due to its international organization, you know, culture.
Neutrality and all
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
And so here, Geneva is part of Switzerland, right next to the French part, right next to France,
yeah.
Right? But it is it's one of the French parts of Switzerland. Switzerland, like Belgium, is a country of many countries.
Yeah, exactly. Switzerland is a federal state. And actually, if you look at CERN on the map, if you open Google Maps now and you search for CERN, then you're going to be basically seeing that CERN is cut in half by the border, right? Half of the border is, half of the CERN site is in France and half of it is in Switzerland. And we actually have some special rules and laws and everything, which kind of allow us to go from one side of the border to the other with some special, you know, diplomatic traits and all that.
Oh, I was going to say, because Switzerland isn't part of the European Union as such.
No, it's part of the European Economic Area, mm-hmm. which means you have free travel and free trade and everything like that. But in terms of laws and everything, they don't necessarily abide to the European Union laws because they're not part of it.
Yeah. Well, and plus, even if you're part of the, like, other member countries of the European Economic Area, mm-hmm. probably don't like it if you transport nuclear material across the border.
Yeah.
So there's got to be some special exemptions for that kind of stuff. Right?
Yeah. We don't really transport that much nuclear. Oh, wait.
Motion sensor. Okay,
yeah.
We're good.
There we go. Yeah. This is going to be fun.
they save electricity here because they need it, because they do a lot of things with electricity. We'll talk about that in a second. Okay, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, so basically the thing is we don't really transport that much nuclear material. There are some things which are radioactive, which come out of the accelerator, because when the accelerator runs, the electronic equipment which is down there, sometimes it gets radiated, so you need to like measure it, and if it's over a certain threshold, it needs to be disposed in a clean way.
Oh,
right?
Of course, yeah. What is a clean way?
So basically it's put in a barrel and shipped somewhere really far away where nobody lives in order to,
space.
You know, touch it, lick it. No, actually, it's probably like some
Antarctica
islands or some atolls, you know, somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, which nobody knows about.
So I love CERN. I've been here once. I came here in 2017 for the very first. We are live from Voxed Days CERN, a conference. Yes, thank you. And you're one of the organizers, yeah?
Yeah, I'm one of the co-organizers, basically. Me and my, let's say, boss, basically, we're working in the same team, and I was a participant in Vox Days CERN in 2019, and then I said, hey, why not make another edition, right?
Yeah.
The pandemic passed, so then we decided, okay, maybe we should start looking into that, especially now because we have a new conference center here called the Science Gateway. And
that's where we are now, in the room closet, basically.
Yeah, basically.
This is a beautiful building, brand new building, right? Last year completed?
Yes, they opened it on the 7th of October last year. So it's basically a 3-month-old building. Some things still need fixing, but most of the stuff that's here, it's brand new and really exciting.
It's got that new
new building smell.
Yeah. Okay, so CERN, so basically you have this, the thing I think maybe most people will know about is the Large Hadron Collider,
yeah.
Which is where you smash particles together and...
Exactly. It's the largest particle accelerator in the world so far. The radius of the thing is 27 kilometers, right? We have super-cooled magnets, the strongest vacuum on the planet, and the strongest cryogenic systems on the planet as well. We need to cool everything almost to zero Kelvin, right? We actually cool stuff to 4 Kelvin in the magnets, which means around minus 268 degrees Celsius.
Oh, okay. Right? So freeze a finger instantly and lose it kind of cold.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's really, really cold. That's properly freezing. That's an old school superconductor, right?
Exactly. That's the whole idea, because we're passing 13,000 amps through those magnets and we're creating a field of 13 Tesla. For those of you that know what that means, it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's actually the strongest magnetic fields that we have on Earth. And what we do with them, then we use the magnets in two different ways, either for detection or for pushing the particles along the pipe, because you don't want it to pass through the wall, right? You want it to keep going in a circle, right?
Amazing. And the whole point of this is what? Like we're doing, we have this 27 kilometer long racetrack for particles, for
protons,
atoms and
usually.
Protons. You can't even see them, they're so small, but it takes 27 Earth kilometers of space just to accelerate them fast enough so they get near light speed.
Yeah,
so that hopefully two of them will errantly collide.
Exactly, exactly. What we do usually, we create a bunch of protons, which gets pushed through the circle, right?
Yeah.
13,000 times a second, they pass through the same point, right? And when we're ready, when we achieve an energy level which is high enough, then basically we collide them in four special spots, which are called detectors, right? We have four detectors on the LHC. We have ATLAS, CMS, LHCb, and ALICE. And each of them have a special way of being constructed. They belong to different collaborations and so on. And basically what happens is, out of the billions of particles, which are in a bunch of particles that collides with another one, around 40 of them actually hit. Everything else is empty space, right?
Wow. 40. Oh, wow. Okay. So, and then what do we get from that?
Yeah. So like, what happens?
Because this is not cheap, right? Yeah. This costs more than a euro to build CERN.
Yeah. The machine itself costs around $2 billion, basically, to build it. The thing that we do out of it, actually, is it's very simple. You take Einstein's equation, right? E equals mc squared.
Yeah.
You flip things around a bit, and basically you obtain mass by smashing things together at extremely high energies. What does it mean to obtain mass? Basically, that release of energy creates spontaneously matter out of nothing, right? And that matter which gets created is usually subatomic particles. So the protons and neutrons you learned about in school, those ones are actually composed of even smaller particles, right? These are called subatomic particles. They're quarks, gluons, and so on, right? And the moment we smash these proton clouds together, the resulting stuff is usually these subatomic particles, right?
Wow.
And together with that collection of subatomic particles and the four energies, the four forces of the universe, we have gravity, electromagnetism, weak and strong nuclear force, we can explain everything in the universe. We can explain how you and me exist. We can explain all the phenomena that happen in the universe, how stars explode, how stars get created, etc. Right?
And so do we have those answers yet, or are we still researching?
We have a lot of answers about... So we have something called the standard model, which is basically a set of equations which was theorized back in the 50s, 60s, which together they explain all of these processes, right? So everything that works on a fundamental, like subatomic level in the universe, every interaction that happens, that is explained through these four equations. And in 2012, what happened at CERN was basically we started the LHC in 2010 and gathered data from the collisions for about 2 years. Then in 2012, CMS and ATLAS, they announced at the same time that they discovered the Higgs boson, which was the last missing piece of the standard model. And now, due to the fact that the standard model is complete, we know that this is the real representation of the world, right? In a mathematical sense, if you want. And now what we're doing, basically, we're measuring the masses of these particles. We're seeing if there's any kind of violation, right? So what we're looking now is like, why is everything made out of matter and not out of antimatter, for example?
So when you talk about the subatomic principles, right?
Yeah.
People who have been, you know, last year there's this very famous movie, Oppenheimer, right?
Yeah.
And in the movie, they pit the protagonist, Oppenheimer, but there seems to be some discord between him and world-famous legend Einstein, right?
Yeah.
And Einstein talks almost dismissively about this subatomic world of Oppenheimer's, right? And that alludes to quantum physics, yeah?
Yeah.
And there seems to be, like, Einstein got so much right, but I think he missed the ball on some of that, right? He didn't quite agree.
Yeah, exactly, because Einstein was generally looking at, the way space and time bend due to the effect of gravity and everything like that, but he wasn't taking into account all these quantum effects, right? So quantum tunneling, quantum entanglement, and all that kind of stuff. This is important as well, and it's something that CERN is studying because we have a quantum computing initiative going on at CERN. But it's not directly tied to the things which are done by the accelerator, actually.
Right.
So because the particles, they get generated, in a couple of milliseconds they go away because the energy dissipates and they're unstable, right? So you cannot have quarks which are just flying loose in the universe. They usually need to be part of a proton or of a neutron, all that.
but that Higgs boson particle that you discovered and proved in 2012 seems to be the thing that confirmed the principles of quantum physics. Is that the idea?
Yes. So basically, it confirmed the fact that there is something which gives mass to everything in the universe, right?
Okay.
Before that, we didn't really know exactly what's the, like, it's really hard to explain basically, but the idea is we didn't know what gives mass to things. Why is one particle heavier than the other? Even maybe though some of them are physically, they're smaller, they look smaller, why are they heavier, right? And basically what happens, the Higgs field is basically like a plane which gets vibrate-y, right?
Okay.
So it vibrates, and basically based on those vibrations, it kind of tells you whether a particle is heavier or not, right?
Wow.
So there's a field, and that field gives mass to everything, right?
So one slack vibrates a lot faster than, say, you know, IRC or something like that. Is that the idea? Very heavy.
Exactly, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, is it known yet what would be necessary to consider these particles stable? That's a good question. I don't understand the question, but I like it.
So basically stable means that you can take those particles and put them together to form something that we know is stable in the universe. So for example, protons, right? Protons are made out of three quarks and glued together with these particles called gluons, right? So you take two up quarks, one down quark, you put them together, and then you glue them using the gluons, and then they stay very, 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 very well tied together. And the problem is that it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to actually to make these bonds, you know, exist again.
Consistently.
So, yeah. So basically what happened is when the universe got born, everything was like a heterogeneous soup of particles, right?
Yeah.
And these were all subatomic particles. Then as time passed and things started to cool down, these particles started forming clumps together, right? And this is the strong nuclear force which kind of brought them together. And it's extremely hard to break that nuclear force. Nuclear explosions, they also come from breaking the bonds between things, but they're not at the subatomic level. You're just breaking apart atoms. You're not breaking apart protons, right?
Okay.
That we cannot do. Unless you fire them through a particle accelerator, and then the moment they hit each other, those bonds break, and then we create, we get some new stuff off.
What is that? Yesterday you were talking about ripping electrons off with the magnets?
Yes. So basically everything that is pushed through a particle accelerator, like the Large Hadron Collider, hadrons basically means something like ions usually, right? So if you remember a bit of chemistry, ions mean something negatively charged, right? So positively charged. So what happens, basically, you have a small bottle of hydrogen, kind of like this big, which is the source of all the protons that come in the LHC. That hydrogen gets stripped of electrons through a device called the duoplasmatron. So if you Google duoplasmatron, it's going to explain to you how it works. And basically what it does, it sucks all the electrons.
To you, maybe. If I were to read it, I would be more confused than when it started.
It sucks all the electrons from that hydrogen gas, and it pushes a stream of protons, pure protons, right? Because hydrogen is one proton, one electron.
Yeah.
And you can accelerate those up to close to the speed of light.
Okay. And so all of this to say that that there's a lot of things happening very, very quickly in a very, very small space. How do you see any of this? Like, you've got all this machinery.
Yeah.
You've got 27 kilometers, but basically the thing that's actually happening, nobody can actually see with the naked eye.
Yeah.
Right? And you described it yesterday as being the size of a human hair, the beam.
Yes, exactly. So we have two beams which go clockwise and counterclockwise in the LHC. When we're ready, when we reach an energy level high enough, because the moment you're reaching 99.99% of the speed of light, you don't talk in speed anymore, you talk in energies, right? The energy is measured in electron volts. We can reach about 13.6 tera electron volts, right? So you need to put a lot of zeros after that. And basically what happens is those two beams, they go in opposite directions. When we're ready, every 25 nanoseconds, we switch the beams together. And in each of the four experiments, the collisions happen, right?
Wow.
These collisions, they generate the subatomic particles that I was talking about, energy, radiation, and all that. You can't be down there when the machine is running because you might die from the radiation levels.
Or turn into the Hulk. That's a possibility, right?
It's gamma rays, yeah. But unfortunately, it doesn't turn you into the Hulk. Fine. And
nobody's tried, though, right?
Yeah, no, nobody's tried. Nobody died in the LHC so far, which is...
I'm happy to hear that.
So basically what we do then is we have huge onion-shaped detectors, right? So it's a huge 3D camera that takes 40 million photos a second, because every 25 nanoseconds you have something happening. And you take each of these events, as we call them, and as the particles pass through the different layers of the detectors, they either get stuck there because their energy dissipates and then they just become part of the detector, right? But it's like subatomic particles. You don't scrape them off the wall after that, you know? And on the outer layers, we detect the things which pass through everything, right? So we have muons, we have neutrinos, which are really hard to detect. And those things are hit by some more specialized systems on the outside of the onion that is the detector, right? And then we have a data center and a server farm, actually, which rebuilds all of these processes into a nice 3D image that can be analyzed.
So the thing that you're conducting along that track is so small, but you have building-sized machines around it, first of all, to protect people, but also to capture it, to understand it.
Exactly.
And so how much data do you get? Where does it go when you... we're talking about, at some point, you get data from that process and it goes into computers.
Yeah.
How many computers? How big a data center? How much do you need Wi-Fi? Is there Slack involved? What kind of software is being used? Are you mining Bitcoin on an incredible GPU farm? What's going on?
Yeah, so in terms of what's going on, actually, you mentioned GPUs. That's actually a rather good point. Many of the software, which is written by physicists in order many of the things which are written by, mostly by physicists, actually. So experimental physicists are a weird bunch because they know data science, they know computer science and all that. So they do have a lot of software which was written years and years ago in order to reconstruct these events, as we call them, because particle accelerators have existed before the LHC as well. It's just...
this is just the coolest.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So basically what happens, one big field of research is actually reconstructing all of these events using GPUs, because you can kind of individually look at each of those things and then put them together in a massive grid. So, you know, the GPU is great for that. And lots of the software is written in C++.
Yeah.
Some of the older one you might find Fortran as well. And basically what happens is once you reconstruct the initial event, you do some initial reconstruction, everything is shipped, because you cannot ship everything. You need to filter stuff using very specialized FPGAs at the hardware level. Mm-hmm. And then it's like saying, okay, this one passes, this one doesn't, right? And this happens at extremely high data rates, right?
Is that hardware?
Yes, it's hardware. It's FPGA based, and the rates are, I don't know, terabytes a second, basically. So basically, what happens?
Too much for traditional data.
Exactly.
Software to handle it.
Exactly. So that's why it's done at the hardware level. So basically, what we do then, we filter out the interesting events and then we send them forward. That saturates like a 10 gigabit connection on fiber.
Wow.
And then that data basically gets sent over all the way to our data center. The data center is not incredibly big. I mean, compared to standards from Google or Amazon or whatever, our maximum power is around 4 megawatts in the data center. Oh, wow. So it's not that big. And we store everything twice. We store it on tape and we store it on hard drives. Why do we store things on tape? Because it doesn't cost any money to keep it there, right? So you don't need to power it with electricity because it's just on a tape. If you ever need it, we have these fancy robots in the data center which move left and right. They pick up the cassettes, right, from the storage, and then they put them in the reader. And the reader is quite fast, but you need to read everything sequentially. So.
Right, a giant SAN.
Yeah.
I've dealt with those. I programmed those.
Oh.
Okay, so that's like offline. There's no cloud here, right? You're just doing your own data center.
Yeah, there are some experiments which use a bit of cloud resources, but basically everything, most of the stuff, like I would say 99% of the stuff that we do at CERN is stored in here, and we don't want to expose that data. We have an open data portal, actually.
Sure.
So everything which gets produced by the LHC is public, and people, if they know how to read the format of the data, there's a special toolkit written in Python called in Python and C++, actually called root. And root is the thing that physicists use to analyze the LHC data, right?
Because it's like this is a multilateral, not necessarily worldwide, but a lot of countries all around the world contribute to CERN.
Yeah, you can say it's worldwide almost. Yeah. So the collaborations have around 100-ish countries contributing.
Oh, there's like 200, so that's half of the planet being actively involved. Noticeably, America is not. Anyway, so you've got all this amazing stuff. And so as a result, everything is kind of open source. You just it belongs to the world. Yeah. The world paid for it and it belongs to everybody. Do you want to, is that question interesting? I don't know.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No.
So the data is available to everybody. You can download it. You can monitor it. People do all around the world, right?
Yeah.
This is a hub.
Exactly.
But there's other spokes all around the planet, people in all the other countries using it to inform their work and their research and their advances as well.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, we have actually a grid. So basically what happens, we have a three-tiered grid of data centers all around the world processing LHC data 24/7. So the problem is we cannot do the processing here at the data center for everything that we do, because processing 1 year of LHC data takes 1 year,
yikes,
more or less, right? So basically what we do, we ship it. We have a huge job system. It's based on HT Condor, if you know about it. So it's like
some like Beowulf or something?
No, it's basically like, I don't know that one, but basically it's a grid system.
Yeah,
it's a big grid system with job submission and all that. So basically,
what about this one?
How much data is produced per reconstruction? So actually that's interesting. In terms of reconstructed data from the experiments, the answer is it depends. Each of the detectors, they produce a different amount of data based on the number of things which come out of the collision, right? What you see normally with the LHC, we have something around the size of less than a megabyte, like a couple of kilobytes maybe, for things like Atlas and CMS and the LHCb. However, there's Alice, right? And Alice looks at, bless you.
Thank you.
Alice looks at much messier collisions, if you want. So 3 weeks per year, instead of accelerating just pure protons, we accelerate lead ions, right? And lead, if you look at the periodic table, it's quite big, right? It has a lot of bunches in it, right? So the moment that lead collides with another lead ion, it produces a very messy fireball, which looks exactly like the universe looked like 14 billion years ago. And the problem is the data size is enormous. So it's around 2-3 megabytes. It doesn't sound like a lot per event. So if you do 40 million of those per second, that leads to a lot, right?
Yeah.
We do have quite a lot of data because we're storing the total amount of data that CERN has from experimental data, let's put it like that, is known to have passed 1 exabyte, right?
Okay, so a lot. So people can download all that if they wanted to, if they have the network.
They can download most of it, yes. It needs to be curated and it needs to be put in like special collections, right? So you have a collection of LHC data from 2012, LHC data from whatever. If you come to the CERN shop, you can actually buy a cassette which contains at least 1 Higgs boson recording of it, right? So it's just you don't know how to read the format because it's proprietary, the tape one at least, not the tape.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so you mentioned Python and C++, naturally.
Yep.
Is there any Java? Like, does Java have a chance to help at all in this high-speed world?
Yes. So there's actually, it's actually funny, but one of the first servlet implementations in the world was actually done at CERN.
Nice.
For a system that we're still using nowadays. It's called EDH. It's not as sexy as the LHC because it's in the administrative sector. EDH stands for Electronic Document Handling.
Right.
And basically, the idea was that CERN was one of the first organizations probably in the world to go paperless in terms of signing HR documents, signing leave requests, all of this kind of stuff. Actually, we have more than 70 types of documents actually available now. And we just recently hit 10 million documents completed, signed, and all of that in EDH. The system has been running for around 30 years. And initially, it was written in C++ with some Java, but it was like applets and everything.
Okay.
So like very, very old school stuff, yeah. And then actually we moved to, you know, to like the traditional client server model, right? And it's been maintained and used for the past 30 years or so. We have one of the oldest Oracle databases in the world as well, still actively being used.
You don't upgrade it?
We upgraded, but in the sense that the data there and the schemas and the continuity of the data, it's like you can find things there which were signed in 1992, you know. And they're still there. So
that's a great database.
That brings some challenges, of course, which are hard to deal with. Sometimes you have a lot of technical debt as well that you need to go through. But
worth it.
The core code, you can find, well, you can't find commits, but you can find comments in the code, because since we moved we kind of lost some of the history at least. Well, actually, when they moved from whatever they were using to CVS and then to Git, whatever.
Yeah, this happens.
The thing is, you can find comments in the code from the 90s written in Java code, right? Which are still running in production nowadays. So that's one of the amazing things that we have.
Is that open source?
It's not open source, right. No. In principle, things that we do are public, but EDH is so specific to CERN's needs that it was not open source.
Makes sense.
We do have a ton of open source projects.
We do.
So we have quite a large open source community.
Where do we go to find some of that?
I think there's an official CERN GitHub account. Yeah, exactly.
Does that look right?
Yeah. We open source a lot of the stuff that we're doing. But on
github.com/CERN as in Nancy.
Exactly. And then there's also some, we do have some other side projects which are not hosted on the main CERN GitHub account.
Okay.
So these are like a tomographic iterative GPU, I don't know. So we have a lot of experiments basically which open source their data. But one of the largest things which CERN produced and is still actively being used all around the world is Indico. You might have heard about Indico.
Yeah.
It's like a room conferencing software, which is used by the UN. It's used by a lot of places on the planet. And actually, the link is getindico.io, I think.
Is this Java?
Yes. This is Python.
Oh, okay. Well.
But other interesting use cases of Java, actually, that we have are for the accelerator control systems. So we have something that basically controls and schedules and monitors all the runs which are happening inside the LHC. Many of those things are written in Java. They're generally full stack applications. The Beams department has a preference for Angular, so they use Angular on the front end. And yeah, it's Spring Boot.
Imagine, Spring Boot. Yeah. Well, that's a thing.
And then recently, I actually met some people from Alice, the experiment that I was talking about.
Right.
And they have, a job scheduling system. They actually prepare analysis for physicists. So the physicists, imagine them as kind of like data scientists. They go to a tool, right? And they want to schedule some analysis, which might take a very long time. So they build up this kind of pipeline. They call them trains. They have this analogy, whatever, with wagons and all that.
Right.
The point is, you have all of these trains being built together, and they're submitted to a job server, which is running Spring Boot. So much of the back end stuff which is responsible for scheduling, for monitoring, for all of that stuff
at CERN, that kind of stuff.
It's using Java in the back end.
Java's gonna be big. You just watch. One day it's gonna be very big. That's super cool. It sounds like a really pragmatic organization, because again, you're doing something for which there is no precedent. Like this is just all I love Python. I mean, I love Java too. Obviously, that's the thing I spend most of my time in is Java. But the language I can say I have the second most amount of experience in is Python. I've been using it since the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Since 1.5. And I just remember, why did people use Python in the 90s? And I remember looking around the landscape and it's like, well, NASA's using it to go to space. ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, is using it to create, they're using it to create Star Wars, right? Google was using it to organize the world's data. These are companies that there's no like corporate product you can buy off the shelf
that
solve these problems. They had a mandate that was unique unto itself on the planet. And they chose Python. They could have chosen whatever they wanted. There was no golf game. Nobody played golf with the CTO of these organizations and said, we've got a shrink wrap thing you can buy for $10 million in consultants, you know? It's just, we need to solve a problem. And they chose Python. And same here, you know, you got Java as well, Spring Boot. There's no, they're just using the, like, if they're using it here, it must be interesting, you know? There's no precedent.
Yeah, it really depends on the current needs, like you said, right? So basically sometimes, for us, for example, so my group is completely Java shop, right? So we have some Python there here and there for gluing stuff.
Java 21 yet?
Java 17.
That's pretty good.
Java 17 for, so if you want to book a visit at CERN, all of the CERN booking software is behind the scenes. It's Spring Boot using Java 17. So.
17 is pretty good. I'll take it. Actually, I was really gonna say like Java 7 or something.
We're going to go for Java 21 soon. It's just we were waiting for some people to provide us because we have the IT department, which is responsible for some of the infrastructure stuff. So they act as our DevOps team, and we ask them nicely, "Hey, can you please provide us an image with Java 21 because everything is in Kubernetes and all that."
Right.
So.
Why not?
And they were working on it, so yeah, it should be fine. It's just we need to upgrade to the latest Spring Boot now, and we're at Spring Boot 3 for now.
That's out of support, but it's also a year plus old. So
yeah,
but yeah, good on you. That's how you're doing good.
We're keeping up. We're almost there.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Actually, I was so worried you were going to say Java 8 and 2.7 or whatever. Like, don't do that. Please don't.
We do have some of that.
We could have just cut the stream right there. We could have ended the feed before that. Yeah. Well, still amazing what you're all doing. I'm just, I'm in awe, truly. I told you before the stream, I get goosebumps just walking around here. I feel like these are the hallowed halls of, this is how we get to the stars, you know, this place is, the world feels so petty and ugly sometimes, but then you come here and you realize we can do amazing things if we put our minds to it.
Exactly.
And this place engenders that spirit of community and collaboration. Mm. I'm privileged. I feel very lucky. Okay, let me see. I got some other questions here. You want to tackle any of these? Will the JDK be serverless? I don't know what that means.
Yeah, me neither. Yeah, I think we can.
In movies, I see that people travel to space, live for ages and hundreds. Is that a fantasy or is it really? I don't know. Fingers crossed, we all get to space.
Though. Yeah, we need to get to space for another one.
The world's too small. Yeah. It's beautiful, but it's, I believe, whatever Star Trek, you know, it's a dream. It's ridiculous, obviously, but it starts with these little particles flying around. Mm. It starts with us understanding that stuff. So I can't thank you enough. I really can't. Thank you so much for inviting me and for having us in this wonderful conference. And we're at Voxed Days CERN. For those of you just joining, we just came from Voxed Days Ticino, where some of us, the speakers, went to Ticino and Lugano in another part of Switzerland, the Italian part of Switzerland.
Yeah.
Here, we're more or less in the French part of Switzerland.
Yeah.
And then there's lots of German parts. Are you from the German part of Switzerland?
Or? No, I'm actually originally from Romania. So Romania is a member state of CERN, and I got to join as well.
I'll be at Voxed Days Bucharest.
All right. Awesome.
Small world, right? And it's just thank you, Voxed Days. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you for inviting me.
And thanks, everybody, for hanging out. I hope you got something out. This is like, I wish you could all be here. This is one of the best. Good morning. Hello. Thanks for joining us. We're about to sign off, but keep your eyes on the channel. I'll be doing lots of live streams today, so it'll be fine. But now I've got to go run. I've got to give a presentation.
Yeah.
Bye, everybody.
Yep.
A Beautiful Podcast is produced by me, Josh Long. I do these podcasts because I believe that everything we do in software is for and made better by people.
I want to hear from you. I'm Josh at joshlong.com by email or at STARBUXMAN on Twitter, where of course my direct messages are wide open. Do you have guest ideas, topic suggestions, feedback? Don't hesitate to reach out. If you like the show, then please consider rating it on iTunes and leaving a review, as it really helps the show. I sampled music from Steve Combs' Them from Morning and Springtime and Steve Combs' Small Victory, both of which are licensed under a Creative Commons license. I'm trying to hire production assistants to make the production of this podcast easier. I want to make sure that we can add things like show notes and transcripts and just generally do more. If you would like to advertise on the show, then please reach out to me. And if you can't or don't want to advertise but would like to otherwise support the show, then please consider supporting me at patreon.com, patreon.com/Josh Long for as low as $4 a month. Thanks again. No harm came to any seasons in the making of this podcast.